Well, I mentioned a little about some of the challenges that are on the campus today, and one of the things that routinely happens on the campus is, well, let me say it this way. College is that time of life where you are starting to see new things, you're starting to hear new ideas in a way that you haven't before. And for students, often it's a time they start to realize how life growing up has impacted them and how that shapes how they view the world, it shapes what they do. And so it's pretty common for our staff as part of our role with students as we're helping students think about what it means to be a leader, what it means to lead other people, and we do training and we do discipleship, to run into opportunities to minister to students or to run into opportunities to speak into students' lives as they start to realize damage that has been inflicted on them, sometimes by friends, sometimes by family members. I had a couple gals who were part of our leadership team, and we had a leadership team of about 8 students at Rock Valley, and so these two gals were sisters, and they were on our team, and they just seemed sharp. They knew the Bible, they had great personalities, they just seemed like they would be really sharp leaders for the next couple years. And at Rock Valley, that's really significant when I can find leaders for a couple years, because usually students are only there for a couple years. And so, you know, kind of connected with them early in October and helping them think about leadership. And so one of the things that I'll do is I'll give them a task, and just see what they do with the task. You know, do they come and ask for help? Do they go and include others to help them accomplish this? How do they respond to the responsibility? You know, do they follow through? Do they not follow through? And so with this brand new leadership team, I gave everybody some tasks to do, and I'm trying to help them know that on a team you're going to be accountable. And so I was like, hey, next week we're gonna check in with everybody and see how you did. And so it's okay if they fail. I expect more than half of them to fail, right? Because I don't always follow through with everything I'm supposed to do, right? But it's part of this, like, helping them learn that this is a safe community. It's okay to fail at times, but it's okay to push each other and say, hey, we can do better. And so the next week came, and as we were going around the table, I could sense tension kind of emanating from these two sisters. And as it got to their time to share, you know, it's like the person away from them and their eyes are getting watery. And then as it's their time, they just both break down crying. And they just start crying. And they're like, we're so sorry we didn't do it. And so, you know, that's okay. You know, what happened? Did you forget? Did something get in the way? You know, and so we kind of worked through that process. And then afterwards, I just pulled them both aside and said, tell me more. Tell me more about why you were crying because you failed. Because failure is essentially a significant part of our lives, right? Most of us fail every day in different ways. And so failure is part of our lives. It's part of us accepting Jesus' grace and learning how to walk with him. And so just said, tell me more about why your response was that. And as they told me more, I learned about their father, who was a jerk, you know, to be real honest, that the failure was never okay in their house. That they always kind of walked on tiptoes everywhere they were when their father was around because they knew that failure would get met with words that were harsh, words that communicated about why they weren't good enough. And so failure for them wasn't an option because it communicated their value and their worth was tied into those words. And so we spent the next couple years with these students helping them hear God's grace and helping them see God as a different kind of father, where they could suffer things and have disappointments happen in their life and it wouldn't define who they were. And Ruth is in an interesting place as we look at Ruth chapter 1 because Ruth is going to let her circumstances and some disappointments and some pain and loss start to define who she is. And it has her in a bad place. And so my hope this morning is that for those of you who may find yourself in a bad place, or you have friends that are in this kind of a place, that you will hear God's heart for you and you will hear God's heart for them, and you'll be able to communicate what His love is about. And the reality is, if you know the story of Ruth, you know that Ruth is married, she has two sons, and there's a famine in the land. Let me just read Ruth 1. I need to remember that I'm in charge. Which way do I point? Oh, I got to turn it on, I bet. It's brand new technology. You got to turn it on and everything. So Ruth 1:1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was famine in the land. And so Ruth 1:1 kind of sets the table of what is happening, the context of Ruth. It's coming during the time of Judges, and if you know the history of Israel during the time of Judges, this was a time they were very unfaithful to God. And because they were unfaithful, God would let things happen to them. He removed His protection from them. And so at the very beginning of the book of Judges, the king of Moab invades. And so the people of Israel kind of did this. They went through this period of not following God. He would bring judgment on them. They would realize they needed to follow God. They would follow Him for a while. He would, you know, they'd raise up a judge who would kind of protect or bring freedom, and then they would go back to their old ways. And actually, Judges ends like the book of Judges ends, chapter 21, verse 6, where it says, "In those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit." The people of Israel were just not following God's law. They were following their hearts, if I can use an American phrase. Everybody does what seems right in their own eyes. And that was what the people of Israel were doing. They weren't living out God's law. They weren't living out the spirit of His law. They were doing what they thought was right. And so famine comes, and I switched Naomi and Ruth. So Naomi is the Jewish woman who is married and has two sons. They flee the land because of the famine. There's just no food. It's not like we just don't even know what famine is in America. I don't think anybody, I shouldn't say that. Maybe someone was alive during the Great Depression. Then you would know more of what this feels like. But for most of us, our biggest problem is they don't have the right kind of bread at the store or the right brand of cereal when we want it. We don't know what famine is, but in this day, when there was no famine, when there was a drought, when there was no crops, there was no food anywhere to be found. And so it wasn't uncommon for people to leave their homeland and travel a long distance until they found a place where there was food. And all the patriarchs of Israel had done this. Abraham had done this. Isaac had done this. And so Naomi does this with her husband and her two sons. They go to the land of Moab. And just to give you a sense of where that is, it's about a 70-mile journey. So the story starts off in Bethlehem of Judah, which is just underneath Jerusalem. And they go up around the Dead Sea and down to the land of Moab. And it's about 70 to 100 miles. It would have taken maybe a week, maybe a little over a week to get there. It wasn't an easy journey, but that's where the food was. And so they leave their homeland, and these Israelites go to Moab. And they get there, and Naomi's husband dies. And that's pretty tragic. Her husband's dead, but she has two sons. And the sons marry some local girls, and so they marry Moabites. And if you know the story of the Moabite people, which I didn't until I was prepping for Ruth, so I'll assume you don't either, that the Moabites actually are the descendants of Lot and his daughters. And so after the Sodom and Gomorrah incident, situation where they flee Sodom and Gomorrah, Lot's wife turns back when she was told not to, and she's killed. And then Lot's daughters are now afraid that there's no men to give them offspring. And so they have an incestual relationship. I was just checking for little ears. They have an incestual relationship with their father, and that's where the people of Moabite come from. So the Jewish people don't look highly on them. They look down on them, but they are cousins. Lot was, the nephew of Abraham. And so there's no love lost between these two people. They do not like each other. But the situation is so desperate that Naomi and her family have gone here. Her husband has died, and then her sons have married those women. Right? Those kinds of women. Moabite women who don't worship God, who worship other gods, and there's just not a lot of respect. And so one of the things that's really helpful as we look at chapter 1 is to understand the value of kids in this culture and the place that women had in this culture. And so Naomi has this loss. Her sons marry these local girls who are Moabites, and they don't have kids. Her two daughters-in-law do not produce any kids. Now, back in this day, it was very clearly only the woman's fault. And then technology has told us that's not true. Most of the time it's men who are the problem. But that's not how society, that's not how these cultures believed things worked. And so the woman was always blamed if she was barren. And so for 10 years, Naomi is waiting for a grandkid. She has two daughters-in-law, and for 10 years she waits. And women's value back then were always tied to men. That the value of a woman was based on her connection to men. If the men were men of high standing in a society, then the women would be women of high standing. If the men were not, if they were poor, then the women's, you know, value was like a poor man's wife. And their value came from their ability to produce kids, because kids were the future. If you didn't have kids, you would have no one to protect you when you got older. You would have no one to provide for you when you got older. The most valuable thing a woman could give her husband during this time were sons. Someone to take care of them in their old age. Someone to pass on the family name. And Naomi has no grandkids after 10 years of her two sons being married to these women. That 10 years of every month, she's waiting for the news that one of her daughters is pregnant, or one of her daughters-in-laws is pregnant. And so not only has she lost her husband, she's in this foreign land, which she wouldn't want to be in, and her daughters-in-law are not producing any offspring. And then we find out that her sons both die. So Naomi now is in this place that no woman would want to be, where there is no male protector. They are far from home. There's no man to protect them. Their worth is only based on men, being connected to men. And now she is a widow with two Moabite daughter-in-laws who are also widows. Naomi has literally lost everything from their cultural viewpoint. She's lost everything. It's hard for us to even define what that would look like. It would, in our culture, it would be losing all of your money, any house you had, any car you had, any ability to provide for yourself. It would maybe be a severe disability with no resources, no family connections. Because back in this day, women couldn't just go out and provide for themselves. They could not work. They were forced to either beg or do other things that no one wanted to do. She is in the worst place possible. And that is where Naomi is. She's suffered these incredible losses. And I wonder if for some of us today, we've suffered losses. Maybe it's the loss of a spouse that we have lived all of our life with that we remember. We don't remember what life was like before they were in our lives, and now we don't know what to do with our days. Maybe it's the loss of feeling normal or healthy, where when you wake up, you just don't know if today is a day where you will be even able to be active. Where what once was a future, where you could think about planning something 2 weeks out, now you don't know if you can even plan something for this afternoon because you just don't feel good. Maybe it's a loss of confidence because your memory is starting to go. And you start to wonder what value you have to those around you. See, Naomi is to the place where there is no value. She is of no value to those around her. She has nothing to offer. And her daughters are widows, and they're barren widows, and they have nothing to offer. And so Naomi is in the worst possible place with complete loss. And in verse 6, make sure I'm on track here. This is what it says. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for him, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. So she hears that the famine's ended, and she's going to go back. And back then, when the famine ended, she's clearly attributing this to God's act. That God ended the famine, that he's providing aid for his people. And so she prepares to return home. And her two daughters, to their credit, are noble. They have family in the land that they're at. But they both pack up to go back with her because there's this assumption that they would care for her. But there's this kind of like gray area, question mark, where really they can't care for her if they go back, because they will be the outsiders with no money, with no resources. They could care for her if she stayed, because they might have extended family who would at least let them live there, live out their lives as widows. Or maybe, if they're lucky enough, a man would be desperate enough to marry a widow who had been barren, which was really rare. But her daughters-in-law are noble, and they decide they're going to go back with her. And at some point on the journey, in verse 8, Naomi tells them this is not a good idea. She says, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown me, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant each of you that you'll find rest in the home of another husband." And so she frees them from the familial obligation to care for her. She's freeing them. She's saying, "Listen, there is nothing for you if you come back. This is a bad idea. We're all in a very bad place. But if you come back, you'll be in a worse place. So stay here." And she's freeing them up. And then she's actually affirming their kindness. And she says, "May the Lord show you kindness as he has shown kindness to your dead husbands, as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me." And the word that is used here is the word hesed. And hesed is used in a few other places in the Bible. It's often translated unfailing love. It's a word that's used to describe a characteristic of God and how he dealt with his people. And the way it's often translated is faithful loving kindness. It conveys God's faithfulness to his people, that he is going to keep his covenant. And so she uses this word that's used in other places to talk about God's faithfulness, his willingness to follow through on covenants, even when people didn't deserve it. And Naomi calls it out and says, "You guys have done this. You have already shown me hesed love. You've already shown me this love, but you no longer need to do that. I'm freeing you from that obligation." And she prays that God would extend his love to these Moabite women, which is really interesting, right? She clearly cares for them, and she is praying that her God will extend this kindness, this covenantal kindness to these Moabites, who would have been outside of God's covenant. And then she continues to tell them to go back. And there's this tender moment in verse 9 where they cry together, they weep, they say their goodbye, she kisses them goodbye, and then they refuse to leave her. And in verse 11 and 13, she's clarifying. She's like, "Maybe you don't understand what I said. There is no hope." Verse 7. "No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than it is for you, because the Lord's hand is turned against me." In verses 11 through 13, she's saying, "Listen, there is no future for you if you come back with me. What am I going to do? Am I going to get married and have sons? And you're going to wait for those sons to grow up and then marry them? That just doesn't work. Right? There is no future for you if you come with me. Go back to your families, and at least you can live with them as a widow, maybe get remarried." And Naomi is clear that it is bitter for her. And she declares that God has turned his hand against her. See, her situation is pretty hopeless. No one is going to take on a widow and two other widows. No one is going to feed three women who have no social standing. Two of them are Moabites. They're others. They're the outsiders. No one is going to want to care for them. That's going to be expensive to pay for three people. There's no future if they come with her. They are two women who haven't been able to produce for 10 years. They are barren. There was a stigma that was associated with being barren. It was seen as God's judgment on you and their Moabite. Like them coming back with her means that she's going to get looked at by everybody in town because she is not part of the group. She's of a different ethnicity. Naomi has no way to provide for herself. She's saying, "I am the Titanic, get away from the sinking ship. It is hopeless. There's no future. If you want to know God's provision, it will not be with me. She is in a really horrible place. And the reality is, for a lot of us, we often let our disappointment, our pain, and our suffering change our narrative of God. And I wonder if some of us have done the same thing. That we have taken on something that has happened to us that was painful, or we've suffered a loss, or we're disappointed with where we find ourselves, and we start to question if God is for us. We start to change the narrative about who God is. Maybe He is loving to others, but He's not to me. And that's what Naomi is doing. She's saying, if you want to experience God's provision, it won't be with me. He has turned His hand against me. And in verse 14, they weep again. And this time, Orpah is convinced. That was the other daughter-in-law. So Ruth and Orpah are the two daughters-in-law. And Orpah's convinced. And so she goes back home. And so we shouldn't judge her harshly for not staying. She's doing the practical thing. She's doing what her mother-in-law is telling her to do. And she has been noble up to this point. She's refused multiple times to leave her, and now she's conceding the point, and she's heading back home. And Naomi tries again to send Ruth home. Says, look, your sister-in-law is going, returning to her people and to her gods. Go back to what you know and where you have family. Go back to what you know and where you have family. And Ruth's response is this. Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where I go, where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. And this is not practical. I would encourage you to read the rest of Ruth. Ruth, if there's something you want to know about Ruth, is she is not practical. Ruth is very strong-willed. She's determined. Her response to being told to get away from me, I'm a sinking ship, you're not going to know God's provision if you come with me, is to double down and actually use the covenantal language that people would use in wedding vows. It says in verse 14 that she clung to her, and it's the same verse that's used in Genesis 2:24, where it says a man will leave his family and cling to his wife. She's doubling down. She's saying, it doesn't matter where you go, I'm going to go. And she even goes to the point of death, of where you die, I will die, and there I'll be buried. She's saying, in this life and the next, I'm committing to you. And then she uses Naomi's God that isn't her God. She says, may the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates us. See, Ruth is actually giving up her chance to get remarried here, a chance to be provided for by her family, her future. She's giving it all up, and she's committing to Naomi, who has no future. She's giving up the people that she knows, the customs that she knows, the culture that she knows, and she's leaving it. And she's going into another culture that she knows will be hostile to her. That's an amazing thing. It is rare for me to experience hostility. I just don't experience hostility. I don't experience people looking at me as other. It's one of the advantages of being a white male in America, to be honest. I don't have people look at me and judge me and say I don't belong. But Ruth is willing to step into that place where she goes, she knows everybody's going to look down on her because of who she is. And she's willing to do that because of her commitment to Naomi. And at some point, Naomi realizes that Ruth is coming with her whether she likes it or not, and she gives up. Naomi returns home, and so they take this long journey, and they get back home, and there's excitement. People are in the town, this is a town of maybe 200 or 300 people. So everybody knew Naomi when she had left years before, and there's an excitement. People hear, Naomi's back. And it says, all the women of the village gather around. They're all coming to see her. They're excited for her. They want to hear what's happened in her life. And here is her response to their excitement. Don't call me Naomi, because that means pleasant. Call me Mara, or bitter, because I went away full, but the Lord has returned me back empty. The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. And she's using the names of God, the Lord, the Almighty, to declare God's power. And those are the names they use to declare God's power and authority. And she is saying that he has turned against her. This idea of afflicted is a legal word that is testified against. And listen to her narrative. She went away full, and she came back bitter and empty. It isn't just that she suffered loss, but now she feels like God has personally turned against her. And I don't know if you ever feel like that when you suffer loss. I do. If I suffer enough loss, or if I suffer enough disappointment, I start to wonder if God is for me. It starts to feel very personal, especially if I don't see other people suffering in the same way. And Naomi is taking this personal, that God is against her. And she's let this disappointment and this pain and this loss change her view of who God is. Right? He's a God who is loving to you, but that's not my experience. And now Naomi has written her out of God's story of love and provision. She's saying, God is against me. There's no future for me in God. He's against me. That's my future. And she's written herself out of God's story and provision. See, when we change the narrative about who God is, we often write ourselves out of God's story of Hesed, his faithful loving kindness. That when I start to act like my situation, when I let my situation define who God is, because my situation is painful, that means God isn't seeing what's happening in my life. Or I'm suffering loss, God must not care about me. When I let that happen, when I let what's happening in my life define God instead of letting God define what's happening in my life, what happens is I assume there's no future for me in God's story. And Naomi has done this to the point where she's changed her name. Don't call me Naomi, that's who I used to be. Now I'm bitter. Now I'm Mara. That is who I am. And she's settling into a place where she is actually refusing to accept God's love and provision. She's saying, there's no future of that. He's not going to give it to me. It's not part of what my future holds. And I wonder for us if that's what we have done in our response to loss or suffering. That we start to say, this is just who I am. I'm cursed. This is just who I am. I'm always in pain. I'm always disappointed. Just call me disappointed. For some of us, maybe it's just call me hypocrite. I always fail in the same way. And when we do that, when we start to give ourselves a name other than God's child or a child of God, we start to write ourselves out of God's story. And when we do that, it's going to be really hard to see God's provision and to recognize what he is doing for us. And so Ruth is saying this. She's saying, I went away full and I came back empty. Now, do you remember who's standing right by her? I'm sorry, Naomi is saying that. You know who's standing right by her? I just gave the answer away. It's Ruth, right? Like, Ruth, how would you feel if your mother-in-law is introducing you to her village for the first time and she defines it as empty? I went away full and I came back empty. And there is Ruth standing right next to her. How does that feel to Ruth? And we don't know. Is she embarrassed? Is she experiencing the embarrassment that she has a Moabite daughter? Is she just so bitter to God that she can't even see that all of what Ruth has given up to love her and to care for her? We don't know. We know that Naomi said she had been a good wife and she had been a good daughter-in-law. And yet in this moment, the word empty is used to define Naomi's life when Ruth is still in it. And so now Naomi isn't just writing herself out of the story of God. She's writing her daughter-in-law out of the story of God. She's failing to recognize what God has put around her and what God is doing in her life. And so this picture of a desert flower stands out to me because I'm convinced that if I was walking in this desert, this flower would stand out, that I would see it, right? And yet, in the place where Naomi is, this is who Ruth is. Ruth is a bright spot, a place where God's love is being shown to her because of Ruth's commitment to Naomi. And Naomi doesn't even see it. You would think that Ruth's commitment, that she came back with Naomi, would stand out to Naomi as, no, something is happening here. God has something for me. This daughter-in-law who didn't need to do this has made this covenant. But in the place she's at, she's missing out on what God is doing because she's named herself bitter and she's refusing to be part of God's story. And there's like a warning here for us. that we can let ourselves get to a place where we are no longer allowing ourselves to see what God is doing. We're no longer able to accept the love that He's offering us or the provision He's providing us because we've written our story and we've written ourselves out of God's story. The end of the chapter ends with a hint towards the future. And that is, the barley harvest had begun. That's how the chapter ends. The barley harvest had begun. And it's a hint that there's light at the end of this tunnel, that things are about to turn around. And my encouragement for you is to read the rest of the book. It's only 3 more chapters. Read the rest of the book and notice what God does in the emptiness that Naomi declares is her life. So spoiler alert, she ends up being a great-great-something grandma to King David. And eventually she becomes, she's in the line of Jesus. A Moabite who had no place in the people of Israel ends up producing, being in the lineage of King David, their greatest king, and Jesus. And so finally, I want to leave this encouragement that even when we've written ourselves out of the story of God's love and provision, His hesed, His faithful loving kindness, remains for us. And so maybe this is for you, maybe this is for a friend of yours, where they are in such a dark place they just cannot see God's love for them. They are refusing to experience it, they're refusing to acknowledge it, and you maybe need to be their Ruth and stand there while they say, I have nothing in my life. And you're like, what are you talking about? I check in on you every day. What do you mean nothing? I have no friends. I thought we were friends, right? I don't know if you have someone in your life where you need to be the Ruth for them. Or maybe you are in the place where you need to maybe recalibrate and say, has God really forgotten about me? Is there no place in my life where I can see His goodness and His love? I can promise you that His love remains for us even when we are unaware of it. Let me pray for us. God, we thank You for Your goodness. We thank You because You are faithful. And even in the times and the places where we fail to be faithful back, You invite us to know You. You invite us to experience Your grace and Your love. And so, God, will You open our eyes to see what You're doing? Will You inspire us today to live like Ruth lived? To commit to those around us? To be those that offer and demonstrate Your faithful loving kindness and help others experience it. And God, we know that that is a work of Your Spirit for that to happen. That is not something we can do on our own, but we need You to be at work in us. And so we invite You, Jesus, to do that. We invite You to come and be honored and glorified as You share Your love, Your faithful loving kindness with us, and You invite us to share that with others. Pray these things in Your name. Amen.